From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
High-profile corruption trials and convictions. We've seen several of them in recent years, including the former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan, who now faces possible prison time. Usually when this happens, lawmakers respond with ethics changes, but we've heard little on that front. We'll talk more about it. And speaking of Madigan, the federal government pulling back its effort to ask for money against the one-time power broker following his conviction. That and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. And Charlie's also been a longtime reporter and observer. And our guest this week, good to have back with us, Ray Long, investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Ray, thanks for being here.
Good to be here, Sean. Always great to be here. I'm very sorry about what is happening in our friends in the Chatham community.
Yeah, it's been a rough week with that, and we'll talk a little bit about some state government political issues as well. And one of those, Ray, has to do, and you wrote this story that appeared in the Tribune involving ethics. I mentioned that here at the start of the show, trying to figure out what may arise from the legislature, what they may try to shore up here when it comes to ethics laws following all of these convictions, corruption cases. What are we hearing so far?
Well, we haven't heard a whole lot about potential proposals that are going to be brought up and voted on. We've seen a variety of proposals that have been introduced. They've all been basically put on hold. They didn't go through their usual deadline process to get out of either chamber. And what we've seen is that there will be a subject matter hearing in the coming week in the House Ethics Committee run by Maurice West II from Rockford. But those proposals are not likely to be dealing with some of the beefier issues. And so we're in a position now where, since Governor J.B. Pritzker has taken over as chief executive in 2019, we've seen 11 lawmakers, now ex-lawmakers, who have either been convicted or pleaded guilty to crimes, most of which are corruption. And the answer we get from people when we press, if you're going to try to tighten some of the loose, weak laws in Illinois, is that, well, they got caught by the federal laws, which we all know are stronger. But the answer does not seem to be, hey, we've got an emergency here. We've had lawmakers going to jail or pleading guilty at a pace that's faster than the Chicago City Council, which has never been viewed as a place of great statesmanship. In fact, it's infamous for sending nearly 40 aldermen to prison in the last half century.
Yeah, in fact, we just had a case here, about 2 weeks ago, of a sitting state senator still in office, but he was brought up on charges that involved bribery. Of course, his case ended with a mistrial. That was Senator Emil Jones III. So, again, whenever I hear this stuff, I always hear people say, like you talked about, Ray, some people say, well, why should we make any changes? These people did something that was already illegal. Now they're going to either be punished for it or at least have their day in court. So there seems to be some thought that, hey, everything's good to go because, look, we're already seeing these cases come to court.
Well, even Governor Pritzker, when asked about it, defended the changes. Now, I'm not saying that you can write a law that will prevent crime and corruption in Springfield. Nobody's saying that. But what you could do is tighten some of the guidelines, which are pretty loose and have lots of loopholes. And Pritzker, when pressed on it, said that every single year he's pushed for a variety of reforms. But the thing is, you don't see him out championing it. And what's particularly unusual or odd about that is for a guy who's thinking about taking on Washington, where there is a quagmire of ethical issues out there, why wouldn't you want to say you have a track record of bringing better ethical reforms in office while you were here and use that to contrast what is going on out of D.C.? He, in fact, as we put it, he fell back on the Springfield bromide that officials who've gotten in trouble are being held responsible under laws that are on the books now. And so, yeah, that's true, but the other laws are so wide open that you're not going to catch too many fish when you don't have very small holes in the net, when you have great big gaps in the net, actually.
Now, Charlie, I think another thing could be that I don't know that people get elected very often for championing the ethics reforms. And I think a lot of the people in the public, a lot of voters probably think, oh, they're all corrupt anyway, so what's the difference? You've followed these for years. You've seen a lot of corruption in state government, and you've seen a lot of changes that have occurred because of it. But has it really moved the needle?
I don't think it has. And maybe part of it is people are just cynical. And as you suggested, they figure they're all crooked anyway. And the thing that I guess gives me pause is that, as Pritzker pointed out, well, we got all these laws and have these people convicted under these laws. And I wonder, what is it about a public official when he sees everybody else going down that he will still go ahead and do this?
Right.
Particularly knowing that he won't have any problem with the state. I don't think the state is, I can't recall any major corruption case prosecuted by state's attorneys. It's all been done by the federals, district attorneys, usually out of the Chicago district. And so I'm saying to myself, why can't these guys learn? Hey, Charlie Wheeler got caught doing that. Well, I'm not going to do that because I don't want to get caught.
Yeah, I think there's part of that. I also think that everybody who hasn't been caught yet, if there is anybody out there pushing the line or crossing the line, they're probably thinking that they're smarter than the last guy and won't get caught. And so sooner or later, you push it a little further, you push it a little further, you push the line a little further, then you jump over it and you keep jumping over it. And sooner or later, you end up getting caught.
Well, yeah. Ray, we did see a lot of changes that grew out of the George Ryan scandal, out of Rod Blagojevich and his time in office. We saw a lot that changed after that point. So why do you think we're not seeing that now? Or at least, you know, I'm not even hearing much from what we've often called good government groups. I'm really not hearing a whole lot out there.
Yeah, the good government groups, they put out proposals, but they are pretty discouraged, in my estimation, that they can't get traction. They've got a few folks who have taken up their bills and proposals, even easy proposals like defining what exactly coordination is between a super PAC and a candidate. One of the few things that is clear on the federal level is that you're not supposed to coordinate with a candidate if you're running an independent expenditure committee, which we shorthand as super PACs. And you're not supposed to do that in Illinois too, but when push comes to shove and a case comes to the State Board of Elections, they say, well, we don't have a definition of what it is, so we can't really say yes or no that this line was crossed. So even simple things like that are not being taken up. And we also have a loophole in the campaign finance contribution cap that basically you can break that cap by putting in your own money, even if you don't have an opponent. The whole idea of putting in an option to break the cap was kind of a defensive mechanism that was put in place by folks who were afraid that wealthy candidates who are unencumbered by laws because of federal rulings that say basically that money is speech, that you can spend all of your own money or family money that you want. And so candidates who felt that they would be restricted under campaign contribution caps thought, look, I need a way to blow the cap open. So the idea was if you had spent $100,000 out of your own pocket and you were running in a race, that would allow the other candidate to raise as much money as he wanted. In other words, his caps would be removed too. But if you don't have an opponent and you break the caps just so you can bring in as much money as you can, that's not what was anticipated in that law, or at least it wasn't vocally stated while it was debated. So there are things like that that happen. People are also loaning the $100,000 to break the cap for the legislative races. It's $250,000 for statewide, but then they raise a bunch of money and because their caps are knocked off, and then they repay themselves. So it becomes unwieldy, and it is beyond what it was originally supposed to do. And then, you know, you can even take it further where Illinois is one of the few states that does not allow local prosecutors to use wiretaps on political corruption cases. And they actually have a law that prevents that. Well, you know, a lot of the cases in Chicago where a lot of these people are ending up convicted are largely based on wiretaps or various secret recording methods. And so when you've got solutions that are out there and they're completely ignored, or then you have to wonder whether there's any desire to actually tighten the rules. These are lawmakers who got into place based on the rules that are in place, and they apparently don't see a reason to change them.
Yeah, Charlie, another thing I think that comes out of this, and Ray touched on that, is these unintended consequences or ways people find to skirt the rules. But in, you know, most of the people that work in state government, I don't think I'm going out on a limb to say this, are not corrupt. And most of the people in the legislature are not corrupt either. But you always have some bad apples. I do know that after some laws have been passed over the last 20, 30 years or so, we've also seen these unintended consequences making work harder to do. Purchasing laws are a great example. A lot of complaining about that in state government, that it's so hard to get contracts approved, hard to get purchases made. So that's another reason to tread a little carefully when you go put these laws in place, I would think.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is those the purchasing laws that you're referring, those restrictions or limitations went in place after Rod Blagojevich. During my time watching this stuff, when it comes down to legislating ethics for anybody else other than themselves, lawmakers are pretty good about putting in stringent requirements. But when it comes to themselves, well, not so much.
Right.
You talk to Patrick Collins, who was a former federal prosecutor. I think George Ryan was one of the people he sent to prison. And he led a reform commission appointed by Pat Quinn. And that was, I think, 15, 16 years ago. And he said that the panel did not get a commitment to give all the group's proposed reforms a fair hearing. Many of the reforms that stalled in 2009 are still relevant today, he said. Some of these proposed reforms have been around, well, in fact, they go back long before Pat Quinn's day. And they just, if it deals with the legislature, it's not so much you can't do this. It's more like, well, maybe you shouldn't do this.
One of the ones that has popped up in recent years is the Legislative Inspector General Office, where one of the previous legislative inspector generals quit because they felt that it was a paper tiger, that you couldn't really do enough there with the laws that were in place. And so it does make you scratch your head that they can find, that the feds can find 11 people in the last 6 years in the legislature who have committed crimes and charged another sitting lawmaker, and yet the legislative inspector general has not had the ability to flag. If I'm correct, I don't think they flagged any of those instances in the previous years. And those, if they're going to be a watchdog, they need to watch.
Yeah.
Well, one of those people that you mentioned was convicted, Michael Madigan, and he now faces sentencing next month, Ray. There had been talk here. In fact, the federal government had put forth instructions that they were going to seek, I believe, over $3 million from Madigan. And now, surprisingly, in just really a very short period of time, have pulled that back. Do we know what's happening there?
There's not a bottom line that we've been able to pry out yet. I'm sure there's a reason, and I'm sure we'll eventually get it, but we haven't gotten to it yet. There's also been a recent development this last week where Paul Descazia, who was AT&T's CEO, who was charged in a case and ended up in a mistrial, that case has now been pushed off a few months, and it was expected to be coming shortly. But the reason, and part of the reason, is because there's so much fluidity in the bribery statute and the interpretation of how you give jury instructions on how to make the final call on people as to whether or not they crossed the line and committed a crime.
Charlie, what do you think, or do you have any idea what could be going on here? I mean, I've not seen this necessarily before. I've seen them change, you know, the amount of time they might seek and somebody to be in prison, but I'm not sure why they came out with this request and then decided to pull it back.
No, and it's really strange because last month, the assistant U.S. attorney was pretty adamant that Madigan should be held responsible for, I think it was $1.3 million, that ComEd paid to his allies who didn't do any work. In the filing, the assistant U.S. attorney wrote that Madigan should forfeit the money, and I'm quoting this now, quote, because he controlled and benefited from the bribes, even though the money was paid not to him but his associates. And they also argued that if it turned out that money wasn't available to satisfy the court's judgment, and we know that Madigan has plenty, the Fed should be allowed to identify or locate properties subject to forfeiture, including substitute assets and to seize property ordered forfeited. So they came down pretty hard. This was in March. And now, what, a couple of weeks later, they told the judge that the government has decided to no longer seek a forfeiture, and the decision is independent from any other issue or briefing in this matter.
And yeah, so, never mind.
And there was no explanation for it.
Right. Right. That's what's got us puzzled. There's obviously a reason. We just haven't been able to uncover it yet.
Could part of it be that there's been a change in the Justice Department? There's a new U.S. attorney appointed over in the Northern District. And who knows? Donald Trump may be trying to cut a deal somewhere.
I think anything is possible, given the state of the United States Department of Justice. But all of it is speculation right now. Sure, there's been a big change with the top of the U.S. Attorney General and the local U.S. Attorney. Some of these things are obviously things that you would speculate could have played a role, but we don't have a bottom line. And I am not going to say it's this we don't know.
But it strikes me as being one of the stranger things that I've seen.
Well, speaking of speculation, let me move on to something else, because there's a lot of speculation out there that we may see some type of transit deal. Chicago area mass transit, I guess there would also be some money, I believe, possibly there could be some money coming for some downstate transit as well. We've been hearing that some stories that they are getting closer to something. Charlie, from what you've read, seems to still be unclear where we're going.
Yeah, I think it's still unclear. And the sticking point continues to be that the transit agencies, the CTA, Pacebus, Metra Rail Systems, want more money. They say they're facing, what is it, a $770 million cliff and that there's going to be a disaster. It's going to be Armageddon on the rails if they don't get the money. But they don't want to change their governance structure. They say it's not a matter of governance. It's a matter of we just want money. And the legislative reaction seems to be, well, we think there's a lot of things that can be done in terms of the governance structure to improve service. To make, for example, if I'm taking the metro from Joliet into Chicago, I should be able to transfer seamlessly to a CTA bus or an L to get to where I want to go, which you can't do now. So that's the difference seems to be the transit agencies want money, and the legislators who are involved want to get some changes in the way they're organized. I think it was, it's been pretty clear that nothing is going to happen before the end of session at the end of this month. And as a matter of fact, I think it was the governor who suggested that this is maybe a topic that can be dealt with in the veto session.
There's a lot of things going on with public transit up here. I saw somebody talking today about how she had taken three CTA trains yesterday, and each one had the smell of marijuana wafting in the air, and also some homeless people, and also some people who clearly needed some mental health help. And that's not unusual, especially on the trains. And when you have those kinds of problems not addressed, then fewer people want to go on the trains, and then you get fewer dollars coming in because if you don't collect as much in fares. And as a result, people want better service. And then when the leaders of these transit systems say they need more money, well, it's almost a chicken and egg. If they had more money, would they put better systems together? Would the trains be safer, et cetera, et cetera? It's a real mess, and it needs to be fixed in multiple ways. If consolidation is one way to do it, everybody would be for that. It's probably not the golden answer to just consolidate, but there are many issues that need to be addressed here, and there's societal issues too. So we've had COVID, we've had an influx of immigration, and all of these issues are not being dealt with in the best of manners up here.
Well, Charlie, Mayor Brandon Johnson of Chicago was down in Springfield this week just for a little bit of time. He did meet with the governor and legislative leaders while down here, but kind of unclear if really much was accomplished there. Maybe there was. We didn't hear about it, though.
No, and as a matter of fact, he met very briefly with the legislative leaders and with the governor, and he was in and out in just a matter of hours. And the interesting thing was when he came down last year, again, late in the day, he wanted a whole ton of money. He wanted like $1 billion more for Chicago schools, and he wanted money for a Bear Stadium. Well, his wish list was really pared down this time. I think it was reported that his wish list wanted $12.5 million from amending a prepaid cell phone tax, $27.5 million from keeping a 9/11 surcharge in Chicago, more investment in the joint city-state shelter system for migrants and homeless people, and a boost in education funding for categorical grants, which is money that is given out to cover stuff like transportation, special ed, bilingual education. And it's prorated because the amount of money that would be needed to fully meet what school districts would be entitled to based on the services that they provide, it's never been at 100%. And so what the Chicago and other school districts are pushing for is to increase the proration. And so if you look at it, what he's asking for is pretty modest compared to the grandiose plans that he unveiled last year. Whether or not he'll get them, of course, is still open to question. And again, we should remember that the governor, this was, a couple of weeks ago, talking about Mayor Johnson, the governor pointed out that work on the budget that's going to be approved later this month began last fall. The governor presented his budget message in February, and so now Mayor Johnson is asking for money, and it's like, where was he back then? It's like he's a day late and a dollar short.
Yeah, that's, I will say that used to be a traditional thing too. We'd sit down there in the 80s especially, and it looks like everything's resolved, and then Chicago Public Schools would come down with a $400 million ask in the last 3 days of the session and throw everything into crisis. But it seemed to level out during the Daley years. There are also issues that arose from some of the deals when they did school reform and handed more of the job to Daley and allowed him to allow his school board to dip into pension funds to pay bills. Now there's a pension problem that is hanging out there. So there are money problems, and there are money problems that have been festering for years. There are money problems, there are ethics problems, and nobody wants to stand up and say, hey, let's fix this.
Let's go now to our notes from the field, and Charlie, we'll start with you this week.
Well, and this is kind of a follow-up on my note from last week. There were two measles cases reported in Cook County, the first ones in Cook County this year. One of them was a suburban individual who was diagnosed on Monday after he or she went to a local hospital. The second case was diagnosed in an adult Chicago resident who traveled internationally through O'Hare Airport in early April. The first individual, the Cook County resident, it's unclear whether that person was vaccinated. The Chicago individual had received the first dose of the two-dose measles vaccine. A couple of weeks ago, there was a measles case involving an adult in Southern Illinois, which was the first confirmed in Illinois this year. Interestingly enough, the cases in Cook County were the first in more than a year when an outbreak occurred in a Pilsen shelter for migrants last year, and it sickened 67 people. Before that, there were no cases of measles diagnosed in Cook County between 2019 and 2024. And of course, nationwide, there have been more than 800 cases confirmed, which is nearly three times the number of cases the U.S. had for all of 2024, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
All right, and Ray.
Well, I'm not much of a betting man, but since one of the Kentucky Derby horses is named Journalism, I think I might just bet on journalism. It's been good to me.
Well, good. Win, place, or show, we'll say. All right. Well, thank you for tuning in again to State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and the Chicago Tribune's Ray Long. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.